Myalgic encephalomyelitis is a word that many of us don't know. Of course, if I say ME, it might become more familiar. But chronic fatigue syndrome perhaps is easier for us to understand in terms of this neuroimmune condition, which plagues so many people, and it's a condition that so many people aren't aware of. So tonight I'm going to be chatting about that. And with me on air, I have Dr. Liz Murray. And also we have Romy Parker on the line. Romy is a PhD physio. She's the acting head of UCT. Liz is actually a breast specialist, oncologist specialist. But Liz, tonight you're not here as a doctor of ME.
No, I'm here because I'm a patient. I had it very severely after swine flu, in whenever swine flu epidemic was, 2009. And although I recovered partly, I still am a patient.
And it is a completely different place to be a doctor, a very well-respected specialist, and suddenly now you're the patient.
It was horrible. And I also found, because it's a poorly understood disease, mm-hmm. Doctors don't like dealing with what they don't know about. Patients are labeled as malingerers,
yes,
as hysteric, and so on. And that was a very hard place to be. Until it helped to discover that all the other patients I came to contact with had similar experiences with doctors, very hostile. And I'm going to talk about a movie about ME, and you will see patients really being brutalized, children being removed from their families by police and taken into institutions, because the belief is it's all in the head, and
yes,
the parents are promoting this sickness belief. And if you take the children away from the parents, the children will get better. Well, of course, they don't. Mm. And in a few years' time, the police have to return them to their families. Mm. This is a special story from Denmark, but it's happened elsewhere, I think.
Mm. And I think that's, for me, the most fascinating part of this syndrome is that it's misunderstood. Often it's not diagnosed. And it's this incredible range of things that can happen. And It can be, for some people, like living with late stage cancer, or even advanced AIDS, or something like a heart failure. And so, as you say, there's a big difference between somebody who's a bit of a malingerer than somebody who's having this incredible range of symptoms that nobody really understands. The hardest for you must have been not only the fatigue, but the way it kind of fogs up your cognitive skills.
Yeah, that wasn't the worst for me.
For most
patients, the cognitive problems are the worst.
Okay.
Mine came with a lot of anxiety that was really horrible, triggered actually at first by TV and film. So I couldn't watch movies to pass the time. It has been written by experts that ME is worse than HIV/AIDS, and this is in the days before HIV/AIDS treatment or cancer, except perhaps in the last 2 weeks of life of those illnesses. So patients can remain bedridden for decades with ME, and it's been proven beyond doubt that it's an organic illness. It's not something in the head. It's not something psychological.
Mm.
There are plenty of tests. Unfortunately, not a diagnostic one, but there are plenty of abnormalities that are found.
If I can chip in here, I think one of the hardest things with all of the people that I've worked with who's suffering with ME, and I think including you, Liz, I think what just compounds the suffering dreadfully is the lack of recognition of how awful the condition is, both by healthcare professionals but also by the public. That you're feeling dreadful, you're terribly ill, and yet the world looks at you and kind of says, well, you look just fine, and, pull yourself together. And I just think that just compounds the suffering enormously, because there is no support and no acknowledgement of what you're going through. Whereas, if somebody in our society has cancer, the emotional outpouring of support is incredible.
Mm.
But for people living with ME, that's just not present.
Ladies, I'm wondering how much of that hinges on the two core elements of this. One is that it's tricky to diagnose, and two, there isn't actually a comprehensive treatment.
If I can come in on the side of the tricky to diagnose.
Okay.
You know, we've got a few conditions that are what we call, first of all, diagnoses by exclusion. So they're not a diagnosis which we make by doing a blood test and saying, this is present in your blood, here's the diagnosis, which is a very simple, straightforward approach. A condition which is a diagnosis by exclusion means you rule out everything else.
Yep.
And then based on what you're left with, you make the diagnosis. But we actually have several conditions that are diagnoses by exclusion, and many of them are very well accepted by people. ME isn't just a diagnosis by exclusion. They're very well-described diagnostic criteria for ME. So I would challenge that idea that it's difficult to diagnose ME, because those diagnostic criteria are very well-described. You exclude other things, and if those diagnostic criteria make the diagnosis. I think that's a concept that we need to challenge.
Yes,
I think perhaps it's more an issue of ignorance, which Liz and I have really come up with as patients and as healthcare professionals in speaking to other healthcare professionals about the condition. Is that it's not being taught to healthcare professionals.
Yes.
And so if you're a healthcare professional and you're ignorant and you're confronted by something, terribly difficult to acknowledge its reality.
Well, I'm thinking of all the things that you have to exclude, things like the obvious one is this patient depressed? Someone who's incredibly fatigued, you know, struggling to get up, and when you get up, it's really slow. You feel like you're hung over all the time. So the first thing you must obviously exclude is depression, some kind of infection, some kind of cardiac problem. I'm thinking of something like fibromyalgia. What else would there be that you have to exclude?
The list is long.
Is endless.
Fibromyalgia is perhaps just the other end of the spectrum of ME, with pain being predominant, whereas in ME the fatigue is predominant.
Okay.
But all the things you've mentioned, Lindsay, most of them can be excluded at the bedside and perhaps with a few blood tests. It's not necessary for patients to go for lumbar punctures. It's very rare that they need to go for MRI scans. So what happens is these really ill patients who should be at bed rest, and the more you make them exert themselves, the iller they get and the worse the prognosis gets, get sent for hundreds of tests completely unnecessary by specialists in this desperate desire to exclude everything else. But the exclusion it can be done clinically and mainly by blood tests, which can be done at the patient's bedside. That's my belief.
Now, I mean, there is a foundation here in South Africa, but what we do know is that there aren't actually accurate figures in terms of how many people are suffering from this.
No, I don't think so.
No, we don't. We do have anecdotal evidence that suggests that ME is more prevalent in South Africa than we suspect. But we don't have the epidemiological data, and that is a gap. Because, you know, a lot of what we teach at medical schools and a lot of what drives healthcare delivery is data about how many people are suffering from a condition. And so, you know, that is an area that we do look at in terms of future research, of identifying how big is the problem and what is the scope of the problem.
How do you identify the numbers when doctors don't believe the condition actually exists, in spite of all the very good research evidence that it does? They will tell me that they've never seen a case, which I can't believe. There's no reason it would be less common than in other countries, and they must all have seen patients which they haven't recognized, and therefore they say, well, it's not a problem in South Africa.
Do you, of course, if you've got anecdotal evidence, and obviously you guys are part of the foundation, which is called the ME CFS Foundation of South Africa, Is in your anecdotal acceptance of this, is it also a picture that we see in other countries where most of them are women?
Yes, if I'll step in here. So ME sort of fits into an umbrella term that we use of central sensitization disorders, which mean that there are some clear dysfunctions in the neuroimmune system. And women are more vulnerable than men to develop these issues because we have genetic and epigenetic characteristics that are different to men. So unfortunately, as women, we are more vulnerable to developing these disorders. But I must say that as a clinician who's been involved in treating with people with ME since I met Liz, actually, I have seen just as many men suffering from this condition as I have women in my setting. So,
okay. So anecdotally, you would say that it's not skewed towards women?
Certainly not in the population that I'm involved in treating.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So can you describe, because it's not the kind of fatigue you come home, you've had a long day and you say, oh, I'm pooped, I'm so stressed, and, I'm so tired and I'm not sleeping well. How is this different?
Can I come in here? And say the terminology, the main symptom is actually called PNE, post-exertional neuroimmunological exhaustion. When people called it, you're fatigued, I just used to say to doctors, yes, I've got fatigue. But it wasn't fatigue. It wasn't like the end of the day fatigue or I climbed the mountain fatigue. It was a completely different feeling that I couldn't really describe. And I think it was PENE. That's what it is. It's an indescribably awful feeling and comes with multiple other symptoms, usually 24, 48 hours after the exertion. And the exertion can be anything. It can be walking. It can be
stress-related.
Too much stimulation, too much cognitive work, all sorts of things.
And you mentioned, Liz,
the next day. By the time you start feeling tired, it's too late.
Okay.
You've left it too late.
You also mentioned that for you it was post-spine flu, so it can be after an infection.
Usually it is, and it's often influenza. But it can also come on just gradually, and people can't say exactly what triggered it.
Liz, do some people describe it, it's like a flu you can't get rid of?
Yes, that's exactly how I used to describe it. And I've been reading something recently that said people say it's like a flu you can't get rid of. I went to doctors and I said, I got flu and I've never got better. Never got flu. I mean, I'm lying there absolutely, finished.
And the cognitive aspect, as you say, it's going to obviously impact different people differently.
Yeah, the cognitive, I think it is supposed to be the symptom that bothers people most, and of course one that affects their work. I would say it's probably worse when you're symptomatic, so it's something that's going to be, like if you stayed up for 48 hours, your brain wouldn't be working so well. Well, for someone with ME, that's going to come on much sooner. I mean, we all know people have car accidents when they've been on duty doing obs and gyne, because your cognitive function is just not working so well. So it just is going to happen much more easily in ME. And people call it brain fog. I haven't experienced what is called brain fog.
Yeah.
But what can help is doing neuropsychological testing, which actually will differentiate between depression and ME. But I think the big differentiation is that the crashing ME comes 24, 48 hours after the exertion, whereas the depressed patient is going to wake up every morning feeling depressed.
Yes. And that's got to be the hardest, that you are able to function, but suddenly, bada boom, bada bang, you just are incapable. And there is that crash you speak of, Liz.
Well, I think this is where we'd like Romy to come in with the management. First of all, can I mention the movie?
Absolutely.
On the 28th of September, there's a movie showing in Kenilworth. And to book for it, there's a donation. But if you can't afford it, don't worry. You contact info@mecfssa.org and you will get payment details and information about it. In the movie, it's filmed by a woman with ME. Well, she gets something that makes her better, something from her doctor, and she goes rushing out around the town. And then, of course, she crashes again.
Yes.
And that is what is so crazy that patients do. As soon as they feel better, they go and do too much. You've got to feel better and do nothing, and then maybe do one extra trip to the bathroom, and then 3 days later, maybe two extra trips somewhere. Very, very slow recovery, and I'd like to hear Romy said talk a bit about the recovery, because this is where patients go so wrong.
Romy?
Yeah, so the recovery model that we use is based on what we call activity scheduling. So we recognize that people's neuroimmune systems, when they have ME, are super sensitive to activity and challenges. And it's really tricky to monitor it because, as Liz has described, if I do too much, my neuroimmune system doesn't kick in straight away so that I start feeling tired and back off. Mm. It takes two days before I have the effect of that. So it's too late for me to back off. So what we do in the rehabilitation is that the first thing that we do is we back right off. So we try and create a foundation where we get patients to rest so that they have a stable base, and sometimes they're doing nothing at all. They're just lying in bed, walking 10 meters to the loo, coming back and resting again, so that we just stabilize things. And then we gradually build their exposure and their tolerance to activity, to cognitive challenges, and we schedule everything. We schedule the day down to the last 10 minutes of, you're going to do this for 10 minutes, and then you're going to lie down for half an hour. And then you're going to do that for 10 minutes, and you're going to lie down for half an hour. So that we moderate activity enormously, and we gradually build up people's tolerance so that their neuroimmune system doesn't flare up and knock them back 24 or 48 hours after doing something. And one of the tools that we're finding very useful and that we've been doing some research on recently, and that I hope will be published in the next month or so, we've submitted it to the South African Journal of Physiotherapy, is using hydrotherapy or aquatherapy, so exercise in pools for people with chronic fatigue. Because when you have CFS-ME, the autonomic nervous system, the nervous system that looks after your blood pressure and your heart rate, and that part of the nervous system that's job is to keep us alive, seems to become slightly dysfunctional and doesn't respond as quickly as it should. So we know that people with ME get orthostatic hypertension. That means that if they stand up for too long, they get terribly dizzy, because your blood pressure is supposed to compensate for that and stop you getting dizzy, but theirs doesn't seem to manage it very well. If we get people exercising in a pool, if you're standing in chest-deep water, the pressure of the water on your feet pumps the blood back up to your heart for you. So it seems to support and stimulate the autonomic nervous system. And the small study that we did was very encouraging because it seemed to show that after just standing in chest-deep water for 5 minutes, people with ME's heart rate, blood pressure, and heart rate variability was more normal than it was before they were in the water, and had a picture that was more similar to the healthy people that we were comparing them to. So our rehabilitation uses aquatherapy to try and stimulate the autonomic nervous system to work in a normal manner, to maintain these normal systems, and really careful use of activity scheduling to very slowly build up people's tolerance to activity without having that neuroimmune crash that happens 48 to 72 hours after doing too much, which we see so often.
And I think something that Romy encouraged me by explaining when I was seeing her was that, so if you do this very, very gradual increase,
yes,
then if you have a crash, it's only going to be back one very tiny step.
Yes.
And when we're talking about gradual, we're talking about, I had a chairlift put in our house, so I would go up one step, and the next day one step, and then go back upstairs on the chairlift. And after 3 days, you'd increase it to two steps. So that's how slowly you are taking it. But then you can only fall back one step or two, and it's not such a crisis.
From what you're saying, for many people it might be difficult to keep working.
I think most people don't work.
Yeah.
Very few people work full-time. I'm very fortunate to be working part-time, and I think very few people actually manage to work. I don't know what Romy thinks.
People who are struggling with the condition, people that I'm working with are certainly not working. But the encouraging thing is that I've worked with many people, like Liz, who've got back to work, and some people who are actually back to working full-time or studying full-time. So they've taken a year of very slow, steady rehab, but they're back to living really full lives.
Mm.
And if you didn't know their background, you would think that, they were just healthy people living busy lives, doing jobs and getting on with life. But in the background, they are managing ME.
Yeah.
But the other thing to say is there are also all those patients lying bedridden, because I think about a quarter of the patients remain bedridden. That nobody hears about. They don't go to their doctors. There's nothing anybody can do for them.
Mm.
They are just simply bedridden. And these are the ones that doctors don't see. They give up on medicine very early on. And so, maybe, Romy, you're seeing part of the spectrum that can actually get up to UCT and not
absolutely.
The ones that are completely bedridden.
For sure. I'm seeing the lucky ones who still have the energy to come and see me and have the resources to be able to do that. I am contacted often by people who are housebound and bedbound and cannot move beyond that.
Mm. There is no single approved treatment for this. Do some people try the pharma route?
Certainly.
To hit symptoms, for example?
The pharma route is there. It's not that the pharma route is to be completely dismissed, but it needs to be coordinated with everything else. And there is some encouraging research going on in the pharma sphere, but I'm hesitant to say that's where the answers lie.
Mm.
That's my feeling at this stage. Liz, perhaps you've got some other insight.
Yeah, well, I think the symptomatic treatment is terribly important. I mean, one of the first things we have to manage is sleep. You turn a corner when you start sleeping. Any patients will not sleep, say, for 2 weeks on end. Or they will just sleep all the time.
Yes.
There's sleep that overcomes you that there's nothing you can do about. And then what tends to happen is they become insomniac, and their sleep is affected in various ways. So firstly, they need their sleep sorted out with sleep hygiene and proper medication. So that's where medication comes in. Then they might have psychiatric symptoms, which I believe some people say absolutely there are no psychiatric symptoms, and there are patients who have no psychiatric symptoms.
Mm.
But when every cell in your body and your neurological system is affected, it's likely you're going to have some. And that could be depression or anxiety. And you could even have a secondary depression or anxiety because you've lost your job and your income and your husband or wife or whatever.
Yes.
So then psychotropic medication also comes in. And then, of course, there's pain medication. So there are lots of symptomatic medications that are necessary, even if there isn't a cure drug for ME.
And Liz, you've raised something that's so important. Obviously we've spoken about the fact that a lot of doctors don't get it, but you've highlighted family, loved ones. It's got to be so difficult to understand this crash and be patient and manage it. And so many partners say, well, why don't you go to the doctor and can't you take a pill for it?
Well, I'm fortunate to have an incredibly understanding husband. He did try at first to get me to walk. You walked around the garden once, try and do it again. And I just had to dig my heels in and say, I'd read a paper, and this is what I'm going to do, which turned out to be the same as Romy's activity scheduling.
Mm.
And I'm not doing what anybody tells me to do, but what I believe is right. But once he had accepted that, he was incredibly supportive. Then on the other hand, I met a man who I said I was out in the middle of the day, and I said, well, I'm here, I'm not working because I've got ME. He said, oh, give me some ME. My sister-in-law's had it, and she does nothing but just slop around the house all day. Her husband's leaving her. And he seriously thought that a woman would choose to hang around the house all day and not do normal things, and that she didn't really have an illness. So I find the attitudes of the spouses just incredible. When you've been married to someone, would they suddenly start lying about their condition? But I think a lot of people do lose their spouses through
this condition. I think it speaks to the frustration because, you know, Romy, you were talking about managing it, but the hardest part for a spouse is to watch somebody you love. And this crippling fatigue, and Liz, you spoke to the fact that you can be sleeping a lot, but you're actually still feeling drained, and you wake up, and you know, given your work as a breast cancer specialist, you feel like you're on chemotherapy, you know. And so,
fortunately, I've got things worked out so that I'm not feeling like that when I'm working.
And it's the sense of frustration. I want to help you, but I don't know what to do. And what you're saying is deep rest is such an important part of managing that crash.
Also, patient autonomy. Everybody tries to tell you what to do. Ultimately, the patient has autonomy. Only the patient knows, obviously with education from someone like Romy, how much more they can manage. And I don't think anybody should be pushing them around, trying to tell them what to do or not to do. They need to work out their schedules with someone like Romy, and then they stick to it. And everybody else should just keep out and support them.
Romy?
And yeah, so I think that's where, you know, with when I'm working with people, what's so important is to ensure that I'm not working with someone who's suffering in isolation, but that I work with them and their spouse and their family and their doctor, and that everybody is on board with this. Because if you're suffering and you're trying to stick to an activity schedule, but people are nagging you and saying, oh, really, it's not that bad. Come on, you're going to come to the Braai today. And you're getting contradictory messages. It's incredibly difficult to walk that path without support. And I think it goes back to what I said right at the beginning, that I think that one of the biggest challenges for people suffering from ME is the lack of awareness within society and the lack of understanding and awareness within the healthcare profession. To adequately support patients through the recovery process. And, you know, how hard it is to recover properly when people just don't get it. And they're constantly judging you, and they're constantly making sometimes what they think are helpful suggestions or just cutting sort of chirpy remarks of, oh, come on, I'm sure you can. You know, how difficult it is to stick to a schedule, which is really what you need to succeed.
Of course,
this is how we as patients, why we hate the term chronic fatigue. To me, that's like saying TB is chronic cough syndrome, you know, terminal TB. I'm trying to teach myself not to use the word fatigue, which after all is not really what I'm feeling. And if I try and explain, to me a shopping center is a complete nightmare because it will bring on such fatigue. Oh, well, says everyone, I also get tired when I go shopping. That is the typical response you get from everyone, even close friends. And it's really distressing.
For me, it's a word that people can understand. When you say myalgic encephalomyelitis or even ME, they think, what's that? But fatigue, most people can relate to. Of course, it does become patronizing when.
But then at least you're not going to tell me you've also got ME. Whereas you are going to tell me that you also get fatigued. So what am I fussing about?
And so really what you guys are fighting for is acknowledgement. And the movie that is screening on the 28th of February, is about awareness, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about a patient who actually self-filmed and then managed to film other patients across the world. It's an amazing film. I mean, for the sort of amateur to do a film that was shortlisted for an Oscar, it's a love story between her and her husband. It manages to be funny as well as, to me, obviously quite distressing because it's a bit close to the bone and the brutalizing of patients in Denmark being put in institutions and so on. So it's an incredible movie, and I would highly recommend it to patients, anybody, the public.
Doctors,
yeah,
Liz.
What the Los Angeles Times says, remarkably intimate, deeply edifying, and a stirring call to action. The San Francisco Chronicle, riveting, equally parts medical mystery, science lesson, political advocacy primer, and even a love story. So, yeah. Maybe at the core, it's a love story about this patient and her husband.
And where is it screening again?
Well, we chose to screen it in a church simply because they were going to do it at UCT, and I just thought the thought of having to find my way to UCT and find parking was too much. So I said, let's ask my church, and they will do it for free, and there's wheelchair access. So
okay.
It's in Christchurch Kenilworth, which is quite easy to find, and there's good parking.
But now the other thing about this...
So they must email the info address that I gave you to book and... pay if they can pay.
And Liz, the other important thing to note is you do want healthcare professionals there, and that there are CPD points to be had.
Yes, I thought there was three, but I haven't had that confirmed. Yes, there are three CPD points, and you can take your family to it. So, yeah.
Because I think that often is a critical turnaround point. Sadly, I mean, healthcare professionals will go to events if they get points.
Yes.
But this, you know, it should be something that you don't have an interest about only because somebody you know and love has the condition.
Yeah, yeah. So we mainly want healthcare professionals to go, but anybody is welcome, patients, carers, whoever.
So some interesting... Some interesting research that we've also done on ME recently is showing that healthcare professionals are more likely to treat people with ME empathically and effectively if they know somebody personally ME.
Yes.
So you might not meet somebody with ME in your social life, but I think this film is deeply personal and will raise people's empathy levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think it's critically important for healthcare professionals to see it because it is an insight into somebody's personal experience, and it will give healthcare professionals that sense of knowing somebody with ME,
mm-hmm.
which means that when they're treating a patient with ME, they will be more effective and more empathetic and take more care in what they do. I mean, unfortunately, all of us healthcare professionals are human beings first.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know someone with the condition, you're more likely to pay more attention to it.
I'm thinking, though, that the people who I think would benefit hugely is all those people who are undiagnosed and might benefit from meeting someone like you, Romy, and know that there are programs which also must give you an element of support.
Yeah, I think that is useful for them, and I think, you know, that's really a big role that the foundation is playing, is to provide support for people who are so lonely and isolated and suffering with this condition on their own, to understand that they're not alone and that there is a community of sufferers out there and that there is a network of healthcare professionals who do understand the condition.
Mm.
So I think it would be useful for sufferers, but I'd put the caveat in there that Liz mentioned earlier, that it may be deeply disturbing and quite close to the bone for somebody who's suffering from the condition themselves to see it on film like this, because it is raw.
Yeah. I think what affected me most in the world, one of the things is, there's a guy in Denmark who's putting all these kids in institutions.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he's asked why this is his approach, he basically said, oh, well, I find it more interesting to look at things of the mind, psychological things and physical things. So because he finds it interesting to think about psychology, he's taking these patients away from their family.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's mad.
Yes.
And there's plenty of research to show that he's on the wrong track.
Yeah.
And that really hurt that he could actually say that without realizing what he was saying.
Well, sometimes a little bit of writer's indignation does go a long way into activating people and calling for things to be acknowledged and treated.
Yeah, so perhaps that's one of the big roles of this film, that unrest will raise voices and will raise empathy, and that people will begin to acknowledge the scope of the suffering and begin to take some appropriate action.
So what we do know is the info at mecfssa.org is a good email connection regarding the movie, in terms of a website?
Yeah, there is a website. I think if you email the info address, it's the same lady, and she will put you onto the Facebook page. And I think it's best just to go through her, Rita, to organize that.
Okay. Ladies, yeah, anything you want to...
closed or private Facebook page.
Okay. Do you want to leave us with anything before you go?
No, I suppose what came to my mind was one of the things is that the suicide rate is higher in these patients. They die of various things. It's not true that you can't die of ME. You can. There was a recent story in Australia. But one of the things that the patients die of is suicide. It is a very, very serious condition.
Well, thanks for giving us the personal side of it and Romy giving us a sense of some things that people can do. Of course, sadly, with the drought, not everyone will have access to a swimming pool, but let's hope that will end soon. Ladies, wishing you well for your movie on the 28th of February, and thank you for your time on Cape Talk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lindsay.